Welcome to Talking History. We're talking today to Richard Wortman of Columbia University. Professor Wortman has followed a trajectory in his research which is not typical of most historians, in that he started out with institutions and then moved to individuals. He started out with working on the development of a legal consciousness in Russia with Russian populism. In his last two books, though, Richard Wortman has been working on the Russian czars, the myths that they created for themselves, and the way in which they used images to convey their ideology to the population. In the time of Nicholas II, who ruled from the end of the 1890s until 1917, this was an especially difficult maneuver to pull off. Because, of course, Nicholas II was faced with a workers' movement, a strike movement, and a revolutionary movement. Nicholas II tried to cope with these in a variety of different ways, but certainly did not stop at the use of force, perhaps most notably on Bloody Sunday on January the 9th, 1905. His police and his soldiers did fire on a group of demonstrators who were unarmed workers, and it was this image that would be used against him by the revolutionaries for some time to come. So on the one hand, we have the image of Bloody Sunday and the putting down of strikes in very harsh ways. On the other hand, we have a ruler who's a devoted family man with five beautiful children. And Professor Richard Wortman is going to talk to us about how we can reconcile these two very different images of the same man. And I'd like to ask you, why do we need to revisit Nicholas II?
We need to revisit Nicholas II because Nicholas II has become the object of various idealizations of people recently, and the tendency to try to apologize for some of his acts and to romanticize his reign and to see perhaps the personal side of his life rather than the historical side of his life and the political acts that that made his reign important and crucial in as far as I can see in Russian history. So I would say that people have enjoyed thinking of his reign, have enjoyed going to exhibitions about him, reading popular biographies, going to movies about him, but this has very little to do with the historical reality. By the same token, in Russia, Nicholas II has become a kind of cult figure to certain people, a saint. He's been canonized, but this has very little to do with what he was like as a ruler, his actions, so that we're dealing with figments of our imagination. And it's worth revisiting the historical Nicholas rather than the mythologized Nicholas that we entertain ourselves with.
But this is pretty interesting, because your last few books have talked about the mythical nature of the Russian monarchy and how much attention they devoted to their public relations, to creating a sort of myth, a sort of image of themselves. So it seems a little surprising, to say the least, that someone who spends his time working on the myth of the czars, or the created myth of the czars, is now saying that we shouldn't look at it.
No, I'm not saying that. I am saying that we should look at the we should study myths so that we are not limited by them. And the myths that are now generated are not the myths that govern the czars. My books are on the myths that govern the czars, which one should study, because these are the myths that Nicholas himself generated, because this is the way he understood reality. But we should not get it into our heads that he understands reality the way we do, and that he looked upon reality with our eyes, with the kind of eyes of either middle-class America or the spirituality of current Russia, because his viewpoint as a monarch, as a European monarch, as a monarch in the Russian mythological tradition, gave him a mentality which is totally alien to ours and which we can study and understand.
Well, then let's go back a little bit. What is the myth that Nicholas created of himself, and how is it different from the myth that's being created about him now?
The myth that he created about himself was one that he didn't completely create it by himself. It was created for him, partly, and partly he created it for himself. It was a myth of a national czar, bound closely with the people, who was a very much akin to the people, who had a spiritual and symbolic mandate to rule the country because of this particular kinship, and one who, because of this, was freed from many of the attitudes, obligations, and constraints that govern the Russian state. In other words, this kind of popular sentiment made him much more hostile to the officialdom, to state institutions, particularly those with legal characteristics, than his predecessors. And as a result, many of his acts were anti-state in goal and in effect, anti-state in the sense of being subversive of traditions of legality and institutionalizations that had been developed under previous regimes. By the same token, he placed great faith in the armed forces. He placed great faith in the, to a certain degree, out of necessity, in the security organs, which pointed towards the development of a kind of personal monarchy based on the people, and which was rooted in certain intellectuals' views. A group called the Slavophiles from the 19th century, which had been developed over the 19th century, the notion that in the 17th century there existed a true Russian monarchy with connections to the people, not corrupted by westernization and not corrupted by institutionalization, with direct feelings for the people. And Nicholas thought that he was restoring this, and he gave all sorts of indications and symbolic displays in the church architecture, in his various statements, in the great costume ball of 1903, that he believed Russia would achieve the grandeur that he thought was in this 17th century. Now, this is a mythical 17th century. It's not a historical 17th century. It's a 17th century of harmony and the unity between Tsar and people. And this has little to do with the history of the 17th century, but the kind of mythical history he governed himself by inspired him in this way, and inspired him to take certain acts that had really nothing to do with the political and social developments of that time.
But what you're saying is that Nicholas II sort of came to this on his own, on the one hand, and yet on the other hand, you're saying that he inherited this conception from the czars that came
right
before him.
Both are true. The notion of the 17th century as a kind of founding period of Russian monarchy was introduced earlier in his father's reign, after 1881, after the assassination of Alexander II, and he grew up with this. But with his father, did not have the sense of identification with the common people that Nicholas had, nor did he have the aversion to the officials that Nicholas displayed. He did dislike certain parts of the bureaucracy, but he was able to work with them. And Alexander III's vision is a It was to change the bureaucracy into a true Russian bureaucracy. And this was really the inspiration of the counter-reforms. Nicholas II never expected to do this. He just didn't like officials, personally, politically, and he expressed his feelings fairly openly, which didn't make them feel particularly good about him.
Isn't this a little surprising for somebody who, after all, is groomed to be a monarch?
Well, that's part of the problem. The grooming to be a monarch was not done with Nicholas II the way it had been, because Alexander III did not take his education as seriously as previous czars did. So the upbringing is a key factor here. Basically, the national myth is set forth in Alexander III's reign tended to downplay the importance of education. And to emphasize the importance of ideology, divine inspiration, national inspiration. While under previous regimes, previous heirs to the throne, the Tsarevichs, heard that they were going to be the rulers of a great country, they had to improve themselves to get up to that level. Nicholas II never had this, which might account for the kind of smug and extremely confident manner he bore himself with, which is quite different from his predecessors.
But that's very interesting, because the sort of image of Nicholas II that one often hears in Western historical scholarship is that he was very insecure and relied on his empress, relied on Rasputin, relied on the advice of other people.
Well, I think that's basically untrue. He was insecure at the beginning of his reign. He was 26 when he took the throne, and he did not feel that he was capable of ruling. Not that 26 was that young for a monarch, but he was a very immature 26. And his father, who died in his early 50s, completely unexpectedly, just had left him totally unprepared. And compared to, say, Alexander II or even Alexander III, Alexander III had sat in cabinet meetings, committee of ministers meetings with his father, and so had Alexander II with his father, Nicholas I. So that's true. At the beginning, he was extremely insecure, and he relied on his mother and the Grand Dukes. However, this insecurity, this personal insecurity, made him extremely defensive, too. He in a way strengthened the basic convictions that he held to, that were guides in how he should act. So in a way, the fact that he was insecure does not contradict the fact that he had these absolutely certain beliefs, because they were the anchor that he rested on. He was afraid to stray away from them, and he became even more attached to these particular symbols and images of the past.
Now, you had said that Nicholas mistrusted legal institutions, mm-hmm. and one of your first books was on, of course, the development of a Russian legal consciousness. Maybe if you said a few words about when Russia got a legal consciousness, this might help us to understand why it was Nicholas more than any other right. czar who mistrusted legal institutions and legal ideas.
Well, the legal consciousness developed slowly in Russia, because Russia lacked a kind of tradition of independent judicial institutions or a reputable judiciary or bar, and it developed largely through the state and through the offices and the efforts of the monarchy. They had a lot of trouble, because it's hard to create a judiciary through a centralized authoritarian state. However, this was done through the early 19th century, but it was a dependent judicial institutions that were basically under administrative control. But all the monarchs wanted reforms, because the judicial system was a source of scandal. It was slow, it was corrupt, it was inefficient. Everyone knew this. Every emperor who came to the throne in the 18th and 19th century talked about reforming the judiciary, though only a limited amount was done. Now, Nicholas I in the 1830s finally got a law code introduced, or a law, digest of laws. And then, during the great reforms, after the emancipation of the serfs, you have the creation of an independent judiciary in the judicial reform of 1864. So by the time Nicholas came to the throne, this was the one of the few independent islands in the autocracy. The other was the local institutions of self-government, which were called Ziemstva. This also meant that more and more legalistically minded officials were in the bureaucracy at the high levels, many of them who were involved in the formulation and implementation of the judicial reforms. And with the revolutionary movement, the autocracy felt itself constrained because many of the courts took the size of the revolutionaries. So with Alexander III's reign, Alexander III reversed the tendency of liberal reform and started this kind of anti-legal feeling in the bureaucracy, and wanted to basically undo the judicial reform, but he only lived 13 years as Tsar, and so Nicholas came to the throne inheriting this anti-legal disposition, seeing the legal system as being basically antagonistic to the principle of monarchy. And all this fit into this Petrine myth, because basically Peter the Great who introduced the Western concept of law to Russia, and going back beyond and finding the true Russian state in a personal monarchy that wasn't encumbered by legal institutions was something that very much influenced Nicholas.
You said that the courts tended to sympathize with the revolutionaries. Isn't that a little bit surprising if they're the sort of agents of the autocracy?
Well, they were agents of the autocracy, but they were brought up in this period when you have improved legal education, acquaintanceship with the West, and a respect for the law. So they felt themselves that they had to follow principles of process and justice and legal principles. I wouldn't say that they all sided with the revolutionaries, but in terms of their legal rights, many of them did, particularly in the early 70s. So some of the revolutionaries were condemned, but a great number of them were acquitted. And the new bar, the new lawyers that appeared after 1864, there were not lawyers to speak of before then. There was no independent legal profession. Often took the sides of the revolutionaries and tried to stigmatize the state and show their oppressiveness and their persecution. Since the court reform of 1864 was based on the principle of open justice and public justice, this came into conflict with the basic notion of the autocracy, that the autocracy should do what it wanted with the opposition.
But clearly Nicholas realized that he couldn't just get rid of the legal system overnight. So how then could he, or how did he, go about trying to convey this image of the Tsar who is, if not above the law, has a sort of a unique mystical relation with the people that no one who doesn't share it can possibly understand?
Yes, well, a lot of these problems were, by the time he came to the throne, were already dispensed with, because a lot of the political trials of these involved were removed from the courts and put into the administrative order, so that by this time the independence of the system in terms of political trials had been considerably abridged. In Alexander III's reign, many of the senators, the Senate in Russia was the highest judicial institutions, had been appointed who were not sympathetic to independent justice. So you had a kind of mix in there, but many of them were. So the way that he dealt with this is basically by high-handedly ignoring institutions. I mean, he did not try openly to dismantle them. And as far as ordinary criminal and civil law went, this did not concern him anyway. But he did not want to follow regular procedures. And, for example, in terms of the introduction of the gold standard, which was opposed by the state council, which was the supreme legislative council. They had no controlling veto on what the Tsar did, but they did vote. But Nicholas didn't even want that, because it's quite clear that the nobles in the state council did not want the gold standard. So what he did simply was to issue it as a decree. And there are more and more things like this when he was given the opportunity that he tried to do. But basically he didn't do very much. He couldn't do very much because the government was on his own. But what he looked forward to is a kind of resumption of the old relationships. The problem is that he had not been Tsar very long when the troubles developed, so whatever his goal was, he could not really realize it. But what he tried to do is to undermine the figures who supported these types of legal institutions, who supported trying openness in society, who supported the independent institutions, and put over them officials who were directly responsible to his own will, many of them not having much to do with each other. So what he was striving for is really a personal autocracy where he decided everything through very close officials whom he could trust, most of whom did not come out of the bureaucracy, became perhaps out of the police apparatus, or were conservative noblemen like Scipiagin, police apparatus Pleve, and not through the other parts of the administration which had been affected. So he's trying to break free from this when things sort of going crazy, and the social movement started to develop, strikes started to develop, the liberal movement started to develop. So he found himself only 6 years after ascending the throne with a growing, the strike movement develops only 2 years after he comes to the throne, with a social movement that he really doesn't know how to handle and that the autocracy had not dealt with before.
So how does he cope?
He copes in the way of the national myth in general, and that is by utilizing force and the notion that if a monarchy, a national monarchy, is going to win the sympathy of its citizens, it has to exert powerful, ruthless, punitive force. And this comes out of a kind of new nationalism set forth by Michael Katkoff in his newspaper Moskovsky Vyedomosti, and his journal that he published. And this is different from the traditional conservatives. The traditional conservatives didn't want industrialization because they were afraid that industrialization would make Russia more like the West, and they were proud that Russia was. The new nationalists thought that the Russian state was so powerful it could cope with any force, that the Russian people believed in the state, there was unity with the state, therefore industrialization could take place, and if you had strikes, the instruments of punitive force would be able to cope with them very easily because the Russian state was mighty. So you could do whatever you want, pretty much. This is what motivated Witter, who was a disciple of Katkoff, in the heavy industrialization.
Wasn't there also a sense that the imperial government could co-opt the strike movement or the labor movement?
That came at the same time. Well, there were two senses, because the government was divided. The Ministry of Interior started to co-opt it, which is another aspect of the national myth. This was began in Moscow, where the Tsar's uncle, the Grand Duke Sergei, was the Governor General under one of the officials of the police called by the name of Sergei Zubatov, where you have police unions trying to make the to win over the workers from the revolutionaries. And this was based on the same national premise, that the people were loyal to the autocracy, that could be loyal if they were given the chance, and that the workers, when the workers were considered displaced peasants at this time legally, could be that their loyalty could be mobilized, and so they taught them that they could get some kind of resolution for their demands through what were called police unions, and there were demonstrations, and they sang religious songs, and they went to church services and had religious lectures. So all of this was another part. But this was basically Moscow-based. Some of the officials in St. Petersburg, among them Witte, were terrified of this because they were afraid that it would get out of hand, and they were proved right. I mean, basically, the union, several of the Zubatov unions got out of control of the police and started striking on their own, and eventually, even before the revolution of 1905, most of them were, they tried to discontinue them.
Okay, so if the police union movement sort of either fizzled out or ended up working out in a way that the government didn't want it to develop in, that there are the punitive measures, like, for example, the harsh putting down of the Leonard Goldfield strike, mm-hmm. for example, just to pick one obvious example. It was this very harsh putting down of strikes that was used by Soviet historiography to portray Nicholas as an extremely, well, I'm not going to say sadistic, but an extremely harsh mm-hmm. ruler. So it's surprising that the new national myth of him, or that the new myth of Nicholas II, is one of someone who's extremely mild.
Yes. Yes.
How do you reconcile?
Well,
this?
I mean, I reconcile it in two ways. One, the Soviets were distorted their history so much that everyone believed that if they said something was black, it must be white, and something was white, it must be black. So there is that impulse. Also, personally, he was mild. And also, he let other people take the. He gave orders very clearly to repress these strikes, but he let other people bear the brunt of the responsibility. Often, he told the Minister of Interior or the generals involved. Now, the Leonard Goldfield strike was sort of a mishap. It's not clear how that started, since it was way out in Siberia. But in Bloody Sunday, it's quite clear that though Nicholas didn't give the orders, that the troops were in, that the generals had the possibility to fire on demonstrations. This was not ruled out, and Nicholas never said it was ruled out. And in February 1917, or January 1917, when everything was breaking loose and there was chaos in Petrograd, the orders that Nicholas gave all the time was be ready to use force, use fire when necessary on the insurgents. That was the only order. And so basically such a retributive policy has its limits, because once the whole population is, you can't shoot down the whole population. So, I mean, this Katkovian mentality was something that was in the end self-defeating, and particularly since it was this that encouraged some of the rapid industrialization that made the mass strike movement possible.
Now, very often when you talk to people who don't know very much about Russian history, and you say, what are your associations with Nicholas II? Very often people will say, I remember those four beautiful girls in their white dresses, referring, of course, to the daughters of Nicholas II. And I wonder if you could say something about the ways in which Nicholas II and the other czars used family portraits and the images of their families as a way of conveying the sort of purity and innocence and goodness and all of the things that they wanted to associate.
He did that a great deal. And not only did he do it, but it was done intentionally. I mean, it's not sometimes we look back and we see these hundreds of pictures that they took of themselves, which, of course, were not published at the time. And they are very charming and very beautiful children. But not only, this was also presented at the time in Popular Pictures and Loop Key, when they appeared at ceremonies and various state events, showing the Tsar as a family man, and the family man indicating a kind of virtue that the Tsar possessed. Now, this had been done more or less through the 19th century, but with Nicholas there's a kind of different side to it. The previous rulers had used the family as kind of the center of the court life of the state, and particularly Nicholas I, but also Alexander III, the family life being presumably a model of morality for the state. Nicholas II and the court, Nicholas II and Alexandra, used it quite the contrary, as something that separated them from the state. The private life at Tsarskoye Selo in the Alexander Palace, they disliked court functions, but they did like to appear in movies, newsreels at the time. They have, and in various pictures showing the closeness of the family, but in non-state functions. In other words, undermining the state, also emphasizing his personal bond in a curious way, a democratic bond with the people as an alternative to the state. So really, he's willy-nilly, I mean, and certainly unintentionally, pulling the rug out under from the existing state structure in terms of legitimacy, because he himself is so antagonistic to it, and he's not, for those who do respect him as emperor, he's not giving any of his charisma, whatever little is left, to the state system.
But didn't all the monarchs of Europe, don't the presidents of the United States even now sort of regularly trot out their families, you know, sort of, here's my wife, here are my children. What's unusual or what's specific about what Nicholas II is doing?
No, this follows the general tradition, but he's doing it much more like a democratic leader, which he's not, than a monarch, because he's separating it from the state. He's showing that he too can have a private life that's unaffected by public concerns. Well, the previous emperors really showed the private life of the Tsar as being absorbed with the state, as their involvement in the guards regiments and the court functions and all of these things. The one way Nicholas did show it involved in the state is in the army, in Alexei's, or the navy, either one. But the navy and the army were part of his image, unlike the state administration. It is very much, he's utilizing, and that's one of the interesting things about Nicholas, he uses democratic type appeals as if he can bolster the autocracy, but really he's really undercutting some of the traditional grounding of autocracy by this way, and the publicizing of the autocracy and the release of various doodads with his picture on it, and a popular biography, and showing him to be an ordinary person. He sort of undermines the sense of the kind of superhuman character of the autocratic body, the autocratic figure.
Is there any way that you have of telling how people responded to these images at the time that Nicholas ruled? Because it's one thing, obviously, to look back and to say, well, this is what happened, but is there any sense for how people actually responded to the pictures?
It's very hard to say how they responded, and it's almost impossible to get any general results. Those close to him had no choice but to respond positively, and they did, and they participated, and they supported his preconceptions. Those who were liberal, since the society was so divided, bitterly divided at this time, those who were liberals clearly regarded it as nonsense and as sentimental trappings on a despotic regime. So it depends. You have the elite culture that was very much alienated from that we know. The general court culture was alienated from Nicholas, and it was separated from Nicholas.
What about the silent majority?
The silent majority we know nothing about. The peasants tended to put on whatever response was demanded at the same time. They followed a kind of peasant monarchism unless they were already had become radicalized. But this is a subject I haven't studied. There's work on it on peasant monarchism and popular mentalities that we'll have to use different sources, and that is very, very, very difficult because peasants tend not to leave very reliable expressions of their viewpoints. So it's really impossible to say how the peasants believe. Certainly in the 19th century, peasant monarchism was dominant. Now there's one view of the point that after Bloody Sunday, the Tsar's that Bloody Sunday discredited the Tsar's superhuman aura. And I'm not sure that it did. I mean, there's no. This is a statement that's been made and is in a lot of the books, but it's not based on any kind of what we would say is social scientific research.
Well, let's leave the peasants out of it for the moment. What about people like the merchants, the small shopkeepers? I mean, after all, not everybody in Russia was a peasant. The clergy, the sort of urban middle and lower classes, mm-hmm. they're the ones who eat up all of the stuff about Diana, Prince of Wales, and all of that. So presumably they would have been the biggest audience for Nicholas II,
right.
I
would presume that a lot of them were loyal, but the percent is very hard to say. I would say, though, that by the time of World War I, it would seem basically his appeal had been largely undermined. Because you see very little enthusiasm for the Tsar in the cities during the war. There's not people are just beginning to do serious research on World War I, and so I can't speak as an expert on this. But the work that has come out has indicated that when they wanted to gain popularity, patriotic, or to raise patriotic feelings, they avoided the figure of the Tsar. So my feeling is that by and large, except for certain conservative groups, certain groups among the clergy, certainly, and certain types of merchants who are still traditional, and my feeling is that the society is really changing very rapidly, particularly after 1900, it's changing very rapidly. So you know, a lot of peasants have become radicalized, a lot of peasants have become liberalized. So I think, and very politicized. So in to get a non-politicized sample of a kind of mentality in the response will be very hard. But that I leave to future generations. I have reached the end of this particular study.
Well, but you said that the family photographs that Nicholas and his family were so fond of taking of one another, they weren't publicized.
They weren't publicized. No, there were pictures that were official pictures that were circulated in the magazines, that were in the newspapers, and it went through the court, the censors. They were very much publicized, and the Tsar, though he hated to appear at court celebrations and court functions, loved to appear in movies. He loved to watch movies and he loved to appear in movies. So, though he was a very private person, it's said, in some ways he's a private person who's very public, and he likes to meet with peasants in the various celebrations. He enjoys them. He thinks he has a particular rapport with the. Of course, they don't threaten him very much. It's very complicated here. The family pictures are for their private use. I mean, they all have Kodaks and they all go around snapping each other.
Now, of course, all of these pictures are being heavily reproduced in various albums of one kind or another. There was the exhibit in which you took part in Wilmington, Delaware, that huge Nicholas and Alexandra exhibit that sort of surpassed all expectations. Why do people respond so strongly to these photographs? Do you have any idea?
Yes, I have an idea. My view is because he's very much like us. I mean, he's a family man. He's very close with his family. This is and he has a kind of modern sense of separate self. However, this very sense of self is contradictory to the basic concept of emperor. because the general sense was that up until the late 19th century, the emperor sacrificed his own personal life for the good of the state, for the well-being of society. As a result, they may take their family seriously and show that they're good fathers, but the family itself also was supposed to serve the state. And here he cuts it apart. He's not sacrificing himself for the state. He's enjoying a private life, enjoying the gratifications of private life, of marriage, of fatherhood, the joys of the heart, the Victorian gentleman. You have the kind of narcissistic gratification of the family, taking pictures of each other, taking pictures of oneself, taking pictures of one's progeny. All of this is very close to what we do. And here you have this person who's very close to what we do, slaughtered in the most bloody fashion by the Bolsheviks in 1918. And so it creates a sense of sympathy with him and a sense of horror. Not that it wasn't a horrible thing, it was a horrible thing. But I think this is part of the appeal, in addition to the fact that they knew how to, they had one type of good taste, they were all very beautiful, extremely well behaved, for many people, and very religious and pious. So if you just took them at their family level, there was a great deal attractive for them.
But you're giving the impression that they had the sort of idyllic family life and that they took very little part in state ceremonies. And yet I start thinking now of all of those pictures of the Grand Duchesses dressed up in the guards' uniforms, and they're taking part in various famine reliefs when World War I is going on. Yes, Alexandra, yeah, and her two oldest daughters go to work in military hospitals.
Right.
So
no, they have to part. They're two separate things. After World War I goes on, then they participate as nurses, which many people in the court thought at first was simply not something that members of the imperial family should do. This again is something much more kind of like a Western European Protestant, which of course she was, the Empress, and not standing, not maintaining their dignity. They did participate; they had to participate. This is a rule, but what I'm saying is that the virtue that he is showing is the virtue of a family man, you see, is the virtue of a close family, not the virtue of a family dedicating itself to the state. The identification of the private virtue taking precedence over public virtue, you see. Not that he didn't also dedicate himself to the state, particularly in the military sphere, and he did participate in ceremonies, but he did so apart from the various members of the court and the institutions, with the exception of the security group. So it is again a question of separateness and establishing his personal virtue. The way they got up it was considered at the time, the way they got up the chambers in the Alexander Palace was something very much like a bourgeois middle class family, which all the aristocrats were sneering at.
Yeah, but he had a great office in that palace.
Oh yes, no, I wouldn't have mind to live there, but I'm not a great aristocrat.
That's true. Neither am I. How are people talking about Nicholas in Russia now, or rather, what sort of a myth is being created of him, or was created of him after Gorbachev, let's say?
Well, there were various, again, it's very politicized. There was no single myth. There was a myth of, among certain religious groups, of Nicholas's our martyr, the pious Christian who died a death like old Russian saints, giving his life for the fatherland. This was one group, and there were nationalist groups who believe this. Then there was a variant of this, which is not necessarily the same groups, that saw the possibilities of an alternative under Nicholas II, because of Stolypin's reform, the individualization of the communal land tenure, though this sometimes did not go over to Nicholas. Somebody like Solzhenitsyn did not have particularly good opinion of, even though he's a nationalist, of Nicholas. So you have pro-monarchical nationalists and anti-monarchical nationalists. And then also there was an attempt to lure pretenders to, and there still is, to take the throne, whose claims were rather illegitimate and were tenuously legitimate at any rate, because by the law of the imperial families there wasn't anyone really who was a pretender. But some Russian officials like Sobchak tried to encourage this, and he brought, Kirill Vladimirovich,
yes,
back, and then Kirill Vladimirovich made the mistake of saying that he was for democracy, at which point a large part of the nationalists deserted him. So they had balls in the Winter Palace and everything, but that I think went by with the fall of Sobchak. And right now, the monarchy is, and most of the pretenders are sort of died out, though there are all sorts of quacks appearing in Petersburg and Moscow who gain notoriety by claiming some being the son of the Tsarevich Alexei and things like that. So there are all sorts of these wild things that are always present in Russia. But there's nothing serious now. But there are nationalist groups that are still monarchical, but they are only a small part even of the nationalists now.
Right, but you're talking about sort of a consciously political sort of movement, and I'm curious about the sort of general impression.
The general impression tends to be very positive. Except for the more critical intellectuals or former left-wing intellectuals, but there tends to be a very strong nationalist group that, and you keep running into people, I don't want to be sexist, but most of them are women, and saying he was such a kind man, such a good family man, such a religious man. Why did this have to happen to them? What did they do to him? You know.
Now, how does this differ, in your opinion, from the sort of attitude that people have in the West, which is, oh, he was like us, and they were really beautiful, and how awful that they died in this way? Is the Russian reaction any more complicated than that?
Well, neither. I don't know which is more complicated, but they're both complicated in their own ways, but they're different in the sense that this is... people in the West, it's a form of indulgence, gratification, entertainment, while in Russia it's connected with the rather complex questions of national identity, which is a major problem there, and the lack of a viable and respectable political tradition in Russian history is something that all Russians of all persuasions feel very badly. So I can sympathize with the Russians more than with the American artistic, the indulgence in decorative art, which is, some of the decorative art is beautiful, but the implications of it, there's always a kind of political subtext there that tends to. The Wilmington exhibition was wonderful and had marvelous things in it, but this doesn't mean that we have to idealize someone who should not be idealized any more than Napoleon should be idealized.
There was something that I thought of, but I can't think. Yes, it's this. That do you get a sense in Russia that when people look at Nicholas II and his family, that this is the alternative, sort of the road not taken? Is there any sense of that?
There is some. Yeah, there's some. There's some, but there are also others who know more and who say that he was like Solzhenitsyn, who was believes in the, and who say that basically he ruined Russia. There are some like that too, and that which was the nationalist viewpoint circa 1915, 1916, or 17, or 18, 19. So it's hard to find any kind of unified view. I think Russians are confused about Nicholas because he was the one alternative. One sociologist, Seymour Lipset, in fact, said that he gave some figure. I think it was 11 of the democratic countries in the West are monarchies. I don't know how he got that, but that was the figure he gave. But in many Western states, the monarchy provides a traditional help for a country in transition to that sort of maintains following the British pattern.
Or in the case of Norway, the monarchy is something that was sort of created
ex nihilo, yeah.
Right.
And
people love it.
Yeah, yes.
Even though it's a totally 20th
century
thing.
It's totally invented and unabashedly consciously invention. And Japan, where industrialization and everything occurred, and with a certain degree of democratization occurred under the monarch. So you had this, and in Spain, of course, they had the example of the Spanish king. But they really did not seem to be. The problem is that in Russia is that most people do not believe that there is a legitimate heir, and quite correctly. I think it's not something that people put much stock in right now. It might help, you know, and it might provide an institution of stability. But the fact of the matter is that the Russian monarchy was a force for instability at a key point, and I think that is the question that has to be answered.
Isn't it ironic that if Nicholas was trying so hard to achieve stability, that he in fact, or at least as you seem to think, that he sort of brought about his own demise?
It is ironic, but it's completely comprehensible. He wanted to bring about stability in spite of all of the conditions and contrary to the social situation of Russia in the early 20th century. So, I mean, it was certainly a kind of utopian answer to this.
Is there anything he could have done?
Well, there's lots of things he could have done. He could have worked with the third and fourth Dumas, which were extremely conservative due to the change in the election laws, and which were completely monarchist, not completely, but I mean predominantly monarchist. He could have worked with them to try to establish some kind of constitutional monarchy. And particularly a time of war where he could have agreed to some kind of ministry responsible to the Duma. But this would have brought in people who were not at all radical, not even liberal, but who were offensive to him because of their legalism or their belief in parliamentary institutions, because he harbored just a tremendous antipathy to any parliamentary institution. So we were thinking, I mean, following the example of the German monarchs in the 19th century and the Austrian monarchs, he could have created a kind of base, a conservative base, but this was simply not reconcilable with the Russian conception of monarchy.
Are you sure? I mean, after all, think of Alexander II and sort of all that people say that he was moving in that direction, and that on the very day of his assassination, the draft of the Constitution was lying there ready to be signed.
Right. Well, he was resisted it to the bitter end, and when he introduced it, the dictator he briefly appointed, Larisa Melnikova, he revised the final version in such a conservative way that it was hardly even a consultative. It was governmental institutions with a few elective members of the people. So by and large, his concession, done only when his life was being threatened, was very minor, and it was done very much against his will. Earlier in the 1860s, he entertained other conceptions of some kind of participatory government, but then he backed away from them and said that it was incompatible with the monarchy.
Well, What about this? All of the wives of the czars, and hence wives and therefore all of the mothers of the czars, came from countries where presumably people did or had worked out this sort of a synthesis. England is one obvious example, Germany, etc. So presumably then the resistance in Russia shouldn't have been that great, right? Because after all, there was some personal contact.
Yes, well, the wives in the 19th century were, their role was told to be basically mothers and symbolic figures and not to meddle in politics. This was very much frowned upon. And so the degree to which they could influence anything, I mean, presumably Dagmar, Alexander III's wife from Denmark, was very sympathetic to constitutionalism. And in fact, her father, the King of Denmark, wrote to her trying to tell her to convince her husband that if Russia wanted a peaceful future, they should introduce some kind of constitution. But clearly her influence on Alexander III, if she had the courage to be critical of him, was relatively minor. But I doubt if she did. She probably knew to keep her mouth shut.
Okay, but what about things like family reunions, where the Russian monarchs rub shoulders with their sort of cousins, etc.?
Yeah, well, I don't think Alexander III, for one thing, he was a very intimidating, imposing personality who made clear his...
Just because he was 6'4 and weighed 300 pounds?
That helped. That helped. And he also had a nasty temper, so altogether. So I don't think they were about to help. And in addition, there were people in the West, in German royalty, who did not believe in constitutionalism and thought it was a mistake. And certainly Wilhelm II was of that group, and he kept egging Nicholas on not to give any concessions. Not that that was a decisive influence, Western monarchs were not universal in supporting constitutionalism by any means.
It's true that European monarchs were not always uniformly enthusiastic about constitutions, but then again, neither are all of the monarchs who are still on their thrones today. Thank you very much, Professor Richard Wortmann, for talking to us here today. And we've been talking to Richard Wortmann of Columbia University.